This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, more interesting news on the economic impact of the Affordable Care Act. The Department of Health and Human Services has reported that healthcare costs for millions of Americans who bought health insurance on the state and federal exchanges remained steady in 2015.
The report shows that per enrollee medical costs in the ACA individual market were essentially unchanged in 2015, even as costs in the broader insurance market continued to rise. And the states with the highest enrollment growth, they saw significant reductions in the average medical costs per enrollee.
This news comes as an important pivot point, Margaret. Several of the nation's biggest insurers have made moves to exit the insurance exchanges, but the study revealed an interesting phenomena. Insurers who sold policies on the exchange set prices low in the first year, and a higher number of sick patients signed up in that first time around.
So the second year of open enrollment, however, saw more healthy people participating, and that, of course, leads to more stabilized overall health costs. So based on these data, officials at the Department of Health and Human Services see a promising trajectory over time. And of course, this dovetails nicely off of a recent Harvard study, which showed that in states where Medicaid was expanded and where low-income residents gained access to health insurance coverage and presumably to health care, that's the ultimate goal: good preventive primary health care and better health outcomes.
So the key word here is patience. HHS Secretary Sylvia Burwell said the study shows the online insurance marketplace is robust, improving as each year passes. While they do predict some slight rises in next year's premium, they anticipate the rate of increase to level off over time as healthier young people enter the risk pool.
And HHS plans to do more outreach into the young invincible demographic during the next open enrollment. That's a population often talked about, but still a work in progress. Those are the healthy young adults who are more likely to feel they don't really need the coverage.
Now let's shift to another topic that has gripped our nation, and that's the prevalence of gun violence. Margaret, while we often take note of the terrible mass shootings which dominate the headlines, we don't think of the 90 Americans per day who die by gun. Some 34,000 deaths per year. Our guest today is one of the world's leading experts on gun violence.
Dr. Garen Wintermute is an emergency room physician at the University of California at Davis, and he has dedicated much of his life's work to conducting vital research on gun violence. We are really looking forward to that conversation, Mark. It's so important.
And also Laurie Robertson stops by, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, who looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Dr. Garen Wintermute in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Aetna is the latest large insurer to take a step back from the Obamacare health insurance exchanges, citing their inability to maintain a healthy profit margin. Aetna has joined large insurers Humana and United Healthcare in pulling out of the marketplaces, opting to stay in just a handful of markets. Aetna CEO Mark Bertolini had reportedly sent a letter to the Department of Justice warning if Aetna's proposed merger with Humana was blocked by the Justice Department, they would pull out of the exchanges. So what does this mean for consumers? Competition in several regions of the country would be reduced for consumers seeking individual plans on the insurance marketplaces. Health law experts suggest, however, that consumers won't likely feel much of a pinch. 8 out of 10 insurance marketplace consumers receive tax subsidies to cover much of the cost of their insurance purchase. And as plan prices rise, so do the tax subsidies. Consumers in parts of the South, however, will feel much of the brunt. South Carolina, for instance, has been reduced to just one insurance carrier on the exchange. And Florida, Georgia, and North and South Carolina are also states that fail to expand Medicaid for their residents living close to the poverty line, leaving many residents still uninsured. The overall insurance picture, however, has brightened considerably since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, according to a report by the nonpartisan Commonwealth Fund. The report charts the reduction of the uninsured population from 2013 to today. About 26 million Americans have gained coverage in that time, but the report also concludes a persistent sector of the population remains uninsured, Latinos making $16,000 per year or less, millennials, and those who live in the 20 states that have failed to expand Medicaid. One of the largest barriers to gaining coverage is the perceived lack of affordability, leading many in this population to go without necessary health care. As the Zika virus continues to pose a threat to folks largely living along the southern coastal regions of the U.S., researchers may have zeroed in on the culprits responsible for interrupting neural development in growing fetuses. In a report published in the publication Cell Stem Cell, researchers at the University of Southern California have identified two proteins in particular, NS4A and NS4B, which affect the brain by targeting a signaling process that controls cell growth. In a report in Kaiser Health News, scientists report their findings that as Zika spreads in the developing fetus, the virus actually uses the disposal process to continue proliferating. Cells began dying as early as 2 weeks after infection occurred. The discovery of this process may accelerate the pace of developing drugs that can counter this devastating result from being exposed to Zika in utero. Uber and Lyft have democratized the commuting experience. Now, hospital executives are seeing the ride-hailing service as a potential tool in getting vulnerable patients to important doctor's visits, especially during that crucial 30-day period after being released from the hospital. Often sicker, older, vulnerable patients without their own transportation face many challenges getting to well care visits or follow-up visits, and a missed appointment could mean another trip to the emergency room. Medicaid covers for such transportation options. However, traditional Medicare does not. But a growing number of hospitals around the country are seeing significant benefit from utilizing these services, eliminating a key barrier to patients keeping important medical appointments. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Garen Wintemute, director of the Violence Prevention Research Institute at the University of California, Davis, an ER physician and professor of emergency medicine. Dr. Wintemute is also a leading global researcher on analyzing gun violence from a public health perspective. He served as medical coordinator at the Nong Summit refugee camp in Cambodia. He earned his undergraduate degree at Yale, his master's in public health at Johns Hopkins, and earned his medical degree and did his residency at UC Davis. Dr. Wintemute, thank you for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, emergency room medicine in the recent past has really been quite an experience, especially with the rise of violence, especially gun violence. And you launched, after your ER experience, the Violence Protection Research Program at UC Davis back in the 1980s, and sort of kudos to you for being a pioneer. And I'm wondering if you could take our listeners back to the sort of the driving mission of the work that you do at the Violence Protection Research Program, and maybe any seminal moment or experience that brought you to the decision to spend a lifetime engaged in this work.
Sure. We, for some years, have used emergency departments and trauma services here in the U.S. to train the armed services combat surgical teams, because they can see battlefield trauma right here in the United States or things like it. Back in the 80s and early 90s, it was actually something of a hard sell that violence was a health problem and not a crime problem. And the best encapsulation of the argument I've ever heard came from a man by the name of David Satcher, a physician who had just taken over at CDC and was asked about this. And he said, look, if violence isn't a health problem, then why are all these people dying from it?
Right.
In my own case, the experience was that time in Cambodia that you mentioned. It was, among other things, a very intensive experience in the power of violence and social forces generally to disrupt people's lives. I came back from that initially thinking I would work in international health, but not long after I got home, realized I can do that work right here. And the other realization, was simply this. The vast majority of people who die from gunshot wounds in the United States die where they're shot.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how fast the ambulance is. It doesn't matter how good the ER docs and the surgeons are. Those people are just dead.
Mm-hmm.
And for me and others, there came the recognition that if we as clinicians want to make the maximum inroad into the number of people who die from firearm violence, we need to prevent them from being shot in the first place.
Well, you know, Dr. Wintermute, you've been on the front line of this even as an undergraduate student at Yale in New Haven, right? Or in Baltimore,
yes,
at Hopkins.
True.
But I'm not sure our listeners would be very familiar with the Dickey Amendment, which Congress passed 20 years ago, which essentially barred the Centers for Disease Control from utilizing any government funds for research that might somehow support gun control legislation. Help our listeners understand, what was this Dickey Amendment and the impact it had on your research or the research of your colleagues? I understand that you basically began to contribute your own personal funds to keep this vital work going. Tell us about that.
So in the early 1990s, we were facing a real epidemic of firearm violence. Rates were increasing very rapidly year over year. And the country did what we do best and should be very proud of when faced with an epidemic. We mobilized. We committed funding to understanding the problem better. Congress was interested in doing something with the results of the research. It's sort of like the mobilizations that we've had for cancer and mm-hmm. heart disease and motor vehicle injuries. We're doing it now for opioid abuse and, mm-hmm. and the Zika virus.
Right.
The difference is that mobilization was choked off. Some of the research that was being done might underlie changes in firearm policy. And there were and are interests in the United States who oppose changes in firearm policy. And I think they took the position that let's simply choke off the supply of the evidence that might make those changes possible. It was a brilliant strategy, frankly, from their point of view. Jay Dickey was a congressman from Arkansas, describing himself, these aren't my words, they're his words, as the point person for the National Rifle Association, carried an amendment that was adopted by Congress and that said that federal funds could not be used, quote, to advocate or promote gun control. There never was really a ban on research. There was a ban on advocacy. But at the same time, Congress took from CDC's budget, this is the mid-1990s, took from CDC's budget the amount of money that they had been spending on firearm research and gave it back to them earmarked for another purpose. CDC overnight, within a few months, shut down their extramural funding program. We had a research program going in large part with their support, and that program very quickly got smaller. CDC still does not fund research. Other federal agencies do. The National Institute of Justice, think NIH, but for criminal justice mm-hmm. matters. And a few years ago, in 2013, the National Institutes of Health launched for the first time in their history a program of funding for research on firearm violence. So there is a little bit of money. Compared to what's needed, it falls way, way short. The question that I have as both a researcher and a clinician is, how many thousands of people are dead today
mm-hmm.
who would be alive if that work had been allowed to continue, if we had been able to enact policies based on the answers to tough questions, when today we don't have those questions answered?
Well, if there were 34,000 gun-related deaths per year in this country, it's about 100 a day. We decided to do a controlled evaluation of the California Armed and Prohibited Person System, which seeks to prevent violence by recovering firearms from persons who may have purchased them legally but have since become prohibited persons. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about your findings?
We work very hard in the United States to prevent prohibited people, felons, people who've been convicted of domestic violence and so on, from purchasing firearms. But we do essentially nothing when the reverse set of circumstances applies. When someone purchases a firearm legally and then at some time later newly becomes a prohibited person. Here in California, an effort is being undertaken to address that gap. The Justice Department here in California has an archive of firearm transactions. And if a person has just had a prohibiting event occur, and if they show up in that archive of firearm transactions, there's obviously a real possibility that they still possess a firearm and are prohibited from doing that. What follows is a knock on the door. You've got some guns that you're really not supposed to have, and we need to take them. And they're taken on a temporary basis because those prohibitions might expire. What we know so far is that such a program is feasible. It can operate. It's been operating for a while now. Thousands of firearms have been recovered. No one's been hurt. Nothing bad has happened. What we need to let some time pass in order to determine is whether the program works in the sense of reducing risk of future violence on the part of people who are affected. And we're in the middle of that work right now.
Well, that sort of leads us to the research that you've done looking at the role that alcohol use and abuse might play in gun violence. You know, in primary care, we routinely screen patients for the prevalence of substance abuse, and we know that there's a corollary, particularly between alcohol and domestic violence. How did you analyze the connection between alcohol or substance abuse and gun violence, and what did you find?
There is a huge body of evidence establishing that alcohol abuse is a risk factor for future violence by itself, even when other risk factors are controlled for, specifically involving firearms. What there hasn't been is a study of whether alcohol abuse is a risk factor for future violence, specifically among people who own firearms. And we've just actually finished one study in this area. And what we learned is that firearm owners are just like everybody else, that even when you control for other risk factors for violence in the future, such as age and sex and a past history of violence, alcohol abuse is a substantial and independent risk factor for future violence involving firearms, major violent crimes like homicide and rape and robbery and aggravated assault. The bottom line is that we're learning that firearm owners aren't different. They're just like the rest of us when it comes to the relationship between alcohol and future violence.
We're speaking today with Dr. Garen Wintemute, Director of the Violence Prevention Research Institute at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Wintemute is a leading global researcher on analyzing gun violence. Dr. Wintemute, in the quest to understand the recent spate of mass shootings that have occurred around the country, the discussion often turns to the link between mental illness and gun violence. And what has your research revealed about the role mental illness? What other impacts have you found that are more likely to lead to gun violence?
Well, no more than 4 to 5% of interpersonal violence can be directly attributed to serious mental illness by itself. There are certain points in the history of a mental illness when risk is increased. One is when that mental illness is first diagnosed. Another is at times of acute exacerbation, when there's been a mental health emergency. And I want to draw a parallel here between mental illness and other chronic illnesses. Public mass shootings are a very, very small part of the overall problem of firearm violence in the United States. Well under 1% of fatalities from firearm violence in the United States come from mass shootings.
Well, one of the problems is just the unbelievable proliferation of weapon ownership in this country. I understand the statistics are that there's now over 300 million guns owned by Americans. Then I understand that you have looked at the whole area of gun shows and gone to gun shows where private gun sales are a common occurrence. Can you talk about this less regulated marketplace where background checks are not required? And what contribution or role do you think these private gun sales are playing in the overall proliferation of weapons and violence?
We have fewer than 5% of the people on the planet. We have more than 40% of firearms in civilian hands. We have a set of policies that make the widest possible array of firearms available to the widest possible array of people for use. One such federal policy to establish what amount to two separate systems of commerce in firearms. If I buy a gun from a licensed retailer, I have to show my ID and fill out a very lengthy form and undergo a background check. And the retailer has to keep a permanent record of the sale, which means I can be linked to the gun. But I can buy a gun from a private party, and there's no paperwork, there's no background check, there's no waiting period. It's gun, cash, and a handshake. And I, the buyer, get to choose which system I'm going to use, the one that involves paperwork and record keeping or the one that doesn't. If I'm acquiring that gun with criminal intent and don't want anybody to know about it, that private party purchase is the only option for me. Nearly 40% of all firearm acquisitions in the United States occur through that unregulated, don't ask, don't tell system. And that proportion doubles from 40% to more than 80% if the firearm is being acquired with criminal intent.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've said a person can have a misdemeanor rap sheet as long as an arm and still be able to purchase a gun legally. Your research has shown that the most telling factor in predicting potential gun violence is a person's prevalence of petty crimes and misdemeanor convictions. I'm wondering how we square your research with the widely varying state-based gun laws. And so tell our listeners what your data has shown you about the connections between lax gun laws and the incident of gun violence.
So it is a myth that violent criminals cannot buy guns legally. A person under federal law can be convicted of any number of violent misdemeanors. Assault and battery is a good example. Here in California, violent misdemeanants are not allowed to purchase firearms, and we evaluated that change in policy and found that it was quite effective. It reduced the risk of future violence in that population by 25 to 30%. We've got 50 laboratories in the United States conducting experiments in firearm policy, and all these experiments are being conducted, and there are very few people available to see what the results are.
Dr. Wintermute, with so many guns in circulation, curtailing the influence of the NRA, a powerful lobby isn't likely to happen anytime soon. Certainly a very vocal contingent in Congress, willing to hold a 24-hour sit-in, demanding a more rational approach to gun policies. Recent attempts to dismantle the Dickey Amendment failed, I should note. But I'd like to ask you, what is your recommendation for the best way forward on getting the proper emphasis on the public health threat of gun violence?
One is to get better evidence. At a time when policy reform might be in the offing, we need the best available evidence to guide those reforms. Here in California, the legislature authorized, and the University of California is probably about to establish, a firearm violence research center. That's a big problem in California as it is nationally. Congress hasn't stepped up. Fair enough. California will do its part. That measure was legislation that was considered by the state legislature. And Jay Dickey wrote a very strong letter in support of that bill to establish a research center. Jay Dickey has had a change of heart and has recognized that his language, which spoke only to advocacy, had been used to suppress research, and he's come to see that as wrong. And it was very heartening to get his support. I think that whatever the outcome of the election in November, there's going to be more support for research on this obvious, large, and pressing problem. I am optimistic. Having lived through the last three decades of this, I know the following to be true: that the conversation has simply not stopped. Mm-hmm. Since December of 2012, people have been talking mm-hmm. without end mm-hmm. and increasingly about how big a problem this is and how we need to do more about it. New people are signing up to help with the research effort, to help with the advocacy effort, if that's where their skill set mm-hmm. lies. I think we are not far away from seeing substantial change for the better.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Garen Wintemute, Director of the Violence Prevention Research Institute at the University of California at Davis. You can learn more about his work by going to ucdavis.edu/VPRP. Dr. Wintemute, thank you so much for the very important work that you are doing and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Sure. Thanks very much for having me.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Hillary Clinton falsely claimed that Donald Trump's campaign officials have called Zika, quote, an insignificant issue. That was said by an unpaid local supporter of Trump, not campaign officials. Trump himself has called Zika a, quote, big problem. Clinton, the Democratic presidential nominee, made the claim about her Republican opponent during a visit at a medical center in Miami. As of early August, there have been 6 locally acquired cases of Zika in Florida. Throughout the U.S., there have been more than 1,800 travel-associated cases. Clinton expressed disappointment with Congress's failure, before going on a summer recess, to pass legislation for emergency funding to combat the Zika epidemic. Clinton's campaign told us she was speaking of Juan Fiol, who was quoted in June by the Boston Globe as saying, "We have bigger mosquitoes to squash than Zika, like ISIS, the national debt, Iraq, and Afghanistan." He called Clinton sophomoric for taking on such an insignificant issue. Who is Fiol? He was identified by the Globe as Trump's vice chairman of Miami-Dade County. But Trump's Florida chief strategist and senior political advisor told us that's not the case and that Fiol is an unpaid supporter. The Trump volunteer told us, quote, "I speak for myself and not Trump. We checked and Fiol isn't on the payroll in Trump's July 2016 campaign finance report." Trump himself has made limited comments on Zika, but called it a big problem in early August. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Tel Aviv computer scientist and developer Oded Ben-Dov has been coding since he was 6 years old. And he's always been interested in hacking systems to make them better. So when this young entrepreneur unveiled a hands-free gaming system on Israeli TV, a local quadriplegic in the viewing audience took notice and urged him to think about adapting this hands-free gaming system to help quadriplegics interact with their smartphones by using simple head movements. Ben-Dov couldn't resist the challenge from Giara Livna, who'd been paralyzed for 8 years following an accident.
And the guy on the call said, "Hello, my name is Giara. I can't move my hands or legs. Could you make me a smartphone I could use?" And that really caught my ear, caught my heart. It was a chance to apply all my techie knowledge towards a greater good.
The two have partnered together on the project, deciding to call the device Sesame Phone, as in open sesame.
So gradually and iteratively, we added more and more configuration parameters to the program. So someone could opt for big head movements or very small head movements. You could use our extended voice commands, or you could use the built-in Google dictation capabilities. We really try to make it as wide as possible for our audience.
They say the results for participants have been nothing short of miraculous. Ben-Dov says he has seen both children and adults formerly locked in by paralysis literally come alive.
It's so emotional, and every user uses it differently. Someone immediately calls his wife. Children, you know, rush to the most popular game and play that.
The Sesame Phone now has hundreds of users around Israel, but they're gathering funding to make the smartphone software available around the world. And Ben-Dov says they've got bigger plans for developing this and other systems that are geared to assist the handicapped community.
I feel there are a lot of technologies that can really be life-changing for some people, but we're positioned well within the special needs space. and we can keep supporting and developing our current products, but use new technologies and offer a completely different product as we're exposed to more and more needs.
Sesame Phone's tagline is, "Touch is overrated." Sesame Phone, a simply devised, hands-free interface that allows the paralyzed and physically handicapped to interact with their world through their smartphones using simple head movements, allowing them a new level of independence and a new chance at self-driven social interaction. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.